This week on Retronauts.
Now you're playing with power. Superpower.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another brand new episode of Retronauts. I am your host, Bob Mackey, for this one, and today's topic is the Super Nintendo's 25th anniversary. Before I start, let's go around the table and see who else is here. Let's start right here.
Hey, it's me, Jeremy Parrish, doing nothing whatsoever to dispel the notion that Retronauts is incredibly Nintendo biased.
Hey, look at history. We'll prove you wrong. Actually, don't do that. Who else is here today?
Hey, this is Tim Turry. How's it going, guys?
Tim, this is his first time on Retronauts.
Who the hell is Tim Turry?
Yes, can you tell us who you are, Tim? I mean, everyone knows who we are, but people might not know who you are.
Sure. Well, one, you guys need to get better locks in your doors.
But, that's true.
Yeah, I'm coming over from Capcom. Just moved to San Francisco. I was formerly an editor at Game Informer over in Minnesota and made the jump over to the publisher-developer side and working on the Resident Evil series specifically, doing some social media, community stuff, all sorts of different things. But yeah, I obviously love video games and am coming to you guys with a slightly different entry point to the Super Nintendo.
That's what I want to hear, because yeah. we are if you couldn't tell, we were baptized into the Church of Nintendo, I guess. In
are
a way.
Coming from the European side? Yeah.
If I was, I'd say I was coming from the Mega Drive side, but I grew up in a firmly Sega household.
I see.
Yes. So before we get to that, though, who else is here today?
It's Ray Barnholt, also a video game company employee.
Ray. Well, since Cat Bailey isn't here, I guess Tim is our Minnesotan for this episode.
And Minnesotan.
I have to ask Tim one thing. There's an RPG series out there. It's very popular in Japan. It's not Final Fantasy. Can you name that RPG series?
Are you talking about Dragon Quest?
Exactly. That's what I wanted to hear. Dragon Quest. I'm sorry. I wanted to pick on a Minnesotan accent.
Dragon.
Yes, yes.
Okay. I've heard that it's not pronounced Magnum or Bag.
But is it Mario or Mario?
Well, it's Mario. I'm not a monster.
Yes. sorry. I didn't mean to pick on you, Tim. I just wanted to do like the sort of like the blood test and the thing to see how Minnesotan you really were.
That's right.
And you passed.
Is that why I am tied down to this couch right now?
Yes, okay. Yes. We're not your bloodline ends here. We're against Minnesotans. But yes, so I wanted to point out something interesting to me at least today. My voice was squeaking because I'm so excited. Is that a little over 5 years after this episode posts, before this episode posts, I started on Retronauts. Jeremy approached me in a dark alley and he shoved a briefcase at me. He's like, "You're in charge now." And he fled. But that's not actually what happened. But this,
I wish. That would be cool.
Yeah, it would have been cool. Come on, Jeremy. But I actually started at Retronauts over 5 years ago doing an episode on the SNES back when it was the 20th anniversary.
And
now I'm back doing the 25th anniversary. Uh-oh.
And I started on Retronauts over 10 years ago when Jeremy also pulled me into a dark alley.
Oh, man.
And we did episode 0 of Retronauts, which included a discussion about the Super NES's 15th.
Wow.
Anniversary.
God. Wow.
So we are.
I wanted to be known that I had nothing to do with the development of this episode and, in fact, said, "I'm not doing a Super NES episode."
Actually, Jeremy,
what I said was,
you asked
there
me
is
to do
no
this.
Way in hell that I'm doing a Super
okay.
NES episode.
But that's why you wanted me to do it, right?
Yeah.
Okay. I just wanted to say, like, I'm at the point in my career in which maybe Jeremy can reflect on this. Like, what do you do? Like, you've written all your retrospectives and then the next milestone comes along. What do you do with your life then? Do you just start repeating yourself? Because I think I'm going to start doing that.
I start making, like, very detailed videos about the libraries
okay.
of these games.
Maybe I need
it's
to start doing that.
It's a bad idea. No,
or maybe
don't do it.
Maybe it's Ray's turn to lead Retronauts. What do you think, Ray?
Sure. How much you pay?
We'll get to you later on that. We're still waiting for paychecks.
you get a free meal occasionally.
Yes. Okay. So sorry for all the inside stuff, Tim. I just wanted to bring that up. And I love doing Retronauts. I'm happy to have been doing it this long. And hopefully we can do it for another 5 years. And until I find some protege to meet in a dark alley and give him all the responsibilities.
Yes. No, it's great. You guys can never, ever, ever stop.
No. I found out this is the one thing that I do that people actually like in mass quantities. So I can't stop doing it, basically, once you figure that out, once you crack that nut.
I need to make a confession here, though.
Uh-oh.
I have no memory of either of those episodes.
You were on
– I remember talking about Metroid 2 on
yes.
episode 0.
Yeah.
Jeremy and I were just talking about the Resident Evil episode, which you were on. And because I obviously love Resident Evil.
I was like, I don't think I was there for that one.
Yeah. Well,
I was.
You were on that Retronauts episode that I started with. I think it was Live 17. And I went back to listen to it. And it's not as awkward as I assumed it would be. I think we'd all just seem very tired. We all sound like Simpsons season one almost. Like, hey, boy, we're going to talk about the Super Nintendo.
That's a perfect analogy.
Oh my God. The one I was on just disappeared, so.
Yeah, Retronaut Zero is hidden.
I got the luck of the draw.
It's hidden in the 1UP vault somewhere. We have to crack it open, and we'll ask IGN about that later. But
I tried to look. Jeremy, I couldn't find it. So.
But today's topic is not my 5th anniversary with Retronauts. It's a Super Nintendo's 25th anniversary, and it's actually a little bit older than that in Japan. It launched November 21st, 1990 in Japan, and we didn't get it until almost a year later, August 23rd, 1991 in America, and this episode should be launching around that 25th anniversary. And I think – I mean, we were always used to a huge gulf in time between Japanese and American releases. But I think in this case it was really because the Super Nintendo was not ready to launch in Japan. There were two games at launch. They just needed something to fight the Mega Drive, which was not hugely successful. But still, it was like the bleeding edge of the console gaming, right?
Yeah. I mean, that was it was kind of a precursor to the Dreamcast Japanese launch. Where it was just like, why did you release it already? You should have waited.
Yeah. I mean, our launch lineup was still very small, but all Japan got was Super Mario World and F-Zero. Surprisingly, not a Mahjong game or like a version of Othello, which isn't that what you – I mean
– Right. Yeah, Gomoku.
Aren't there a lot of those usually for Japanese systems? Like, okay,
usually
here's your Go game.
Early. Yeah, starting with the Famicom. Like the fourth and fifth games released for Famicom. I was just writing about this morning, where Gomoku, Renju, and Mahjong.
So I assume there was some like celebrity licensed Go game before we got the Super Nintendo. But what's important to note, we'll get into the system and its specifics and whatever later. But as far as the launch goes, ours was pretty good, I think, in terms of showing off what the system could do. And we got Super Mario World, of course. We did an entire episode on that. Please look it up. F-Zero and Pilot Wings, SimCity, and Gradius 3. That was our launch lineup. And
Gradius 3 maybe not so good at showing off what the system could do, or maybe not good at showing what the system could do well.
It could show
showing off like, the weaknesses of the system.
Yeah. If anything, it helped me play Gradius because I was like, oh, this slowdown is a feature, right?
Because this game runs at half speed. I can play this. I can do this.
I don't need a slow-mo controller. And from the beginning, I think the Super Nintendo was really showing how different it was from the Genesis, and it was showing the direction Nintendo was going. Sega was still focused on arcade hardware too, and I think the Genesis, a lot of it was like, we're going to give you arcade experiences, and the Super Nintendo, I think, was like, we'll give you experiences you can only have here, or maybe on the PC. So I feel like things like Pilot Wings and SimCity, they were very PC-oriented experiences, but kind of simplified, made a little more easier to handle for a console. Do people agree with me on this? I feel like they were going for a different kind of approach than just arcade.
Yeah, I mean, how much do we really want to talk about what was inside these systems?
I
think that's pretty telling.
That's our next topic. I just kind of wanted to go over just the general launch first. But,
okay.
But I mean, in terms of sales, I didn't want to cover that. It's funny when you look at these Nintendo systems where the NES had 61 – I'm sorry. No, the NES – yeah, NES had 61.91 million. The Super Nintendo had 49.1 million, and then I jumped ahead to the Wii just to see the difference, and the Wii had 101.52 million.
Well, Nintendo sales for consoles, like install bases, were on a progressively downward slope.
Gradually shrunk,
like each system sold about two-thirds as much as the previous one until Wii suddenly like sold what – 3 or 4 times what the GameCube did?
Yes. The GameCube was probably like 30 million, I'm guessing, something like that.
And then actually, if you look at Wii U's install base, it actually follows that curve. Like Wii is this bizarre anomaly sticking out in the middle, but but it's actually like that downward slope just continues.
So the Wii was an anomaly, but I thought it was interesting to see like just how people were gradually backing away from games as they became more complicated. But we can't talk about the hardware.
I don't think that's true. I think there was just more competition for Nintendo.
That could be it too,
I mean, the NES sold 60 million units, and it was like 90% of the install base in Japan and in America. It wasn't as strong in Europe, but like – that was pretty much the like that sales that sales figure was basically what the U.S. and Japanese markets could bear at that point.
Right. Yeah.
Whereas if you look at the 16-bit market, you had a pretty even split between Super NES, and Genesis. So you have, at least in the US and also in Europe, so you know, you have like 60 million game systems installed in the 8-bit era, like 65 million maybe. And then in the 8-bit era, it's more like 80 or 90 million. Mm. So games were actually growing. It's just that Nintendo didn't own nearly the same slice of the pie right. as they had in the 8-bit era.
I was kind of using anecdotal evidence because I feel like growing up as a kid, and we talked about this on the Zelda episode where Zelda was, in my perspective, the dad game. It was like all the dads were playing Zelda. And I felt like everyone's parents were playing the NES, but when the SNES came out, I feel like that's when parents of my generation or my parents and other people's parents really just stopped playing video games. I don't know if it was the controller that was too intimidating. I think that was a huge part of it for my mom. Like, she played NES games. But when you're confronted with this thing with, like, two times the number of buttons, you could be like, okay, I'm done. Like,
plus shoulder things.
Yeah,
the
yeah.
shoulder buttons
what,
were maybe,
what were
like –
those even?
They're yeah. the most underutilized buttons, I yes. think, in, like, all video game history.
No one knew what to do with those until Final Fantasy VI, I want to say, where, yeah. like, people were like, oh – toggle between characters and menus.
Not
that
even,
makes sense.
Not even Final Fantasy IV figured that out. But we'll talk about the hardware now. It's a good segue. So this is designed by Masayuki Uemura.
Yes.
Jeremy, you talked to him.
I did.
What did you talk to him about? Just the NES?
The NES.
Okay, right.
I wish I had had time to talk to him about Super NES because that's much less of an explored area of
I agree.
His history.
Yeah.
But I was like specifically there to talk about the NES's 30th anniversary. So mm-hmm. I didn't have the opportunity. But
yeah.
Yeah, he was Nintendo R&D3, one of the development, like hardware development people. He had worked with Sharp before he came to Nintendo, and his relationship with Sharp and Mitsubishi, I can't remember exactly, or Hitachi, I don't know. Anyway, his relationship was really instrumental in making the NES happen, the Famicom hardware.
Right. And do you know if Did he design the American versions of the NES and Super
NES?
No, I mean,
those,
so.
Those were industrial designers. He yeah. was an engineer. He designed the interiors,
Got
the
it.
Insides. And, you know, it's someone else's job to put together the cases, the exteriors. I think the NES was the case design was – and maybe for the Super NES was done in America. I know
okay.
it was
yeah.
Both you might know the names of the person who
Lance
designed
Barr was the designer.
Okay, that's right.
He drew
yeah.
up the designs for both.
That was on
of
tip
those,
of my tongue.
So, yeah. He was at NOA, yeah.
Looking back aesthetically, like, do you guys think that the NES or the SNES was – which one do you think was more like aesthetically pleasing?
I would say SNES for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. The Super NES? No, I hate the design of that console. I think it's garbage. I like the NES.
You have to step back and say, I love them both equally.
Yeah,
because
sorry.
You can't really
my children.
That.
My children, yeah.
No, I mean, I loved the Super NES hardware and the game experiences. Yeah. But, I mean, from the very beginning, I was like, this console looks really gross.
I thought that, like,
ugly.
The purple on gray was like a really cool contrast I hadn't considered before. But
the
then
colors were fine.
I like the colors a lot, yeah.
There's something about like the NES and the mystery of opening up, you know, a little trap door and your
yeah.
game goes away in there. And that
so like, is
undeniable.
It a treasure or is it a mimic?
Yeah.
Will it attack
or will it turn on?
I'm glad you brought that up because the Famicom, as we all know, was top loading. The NES was more of a VCR type thing to fool people into thinking it wasn't a video game system.
But
for
unfortunately,
the most
it
part.
Also fooled people into thinking it was a safe surface to set their drinks.
yeah.
And that's, yeah.
Yeah, I can see a lot of problems happening
around.
There. But, I mean, there were a lot of problems with NES models because of the – I forget what would happen.
Zero insertion force.
Exactly.
Right? The pins would get bent.
So, luckily, they went for the American version of the Super Famicom. They stuck with the top loading.
But
they didn't
just keep the Japanese and European design, which was very clean and elegant.
I love the Super Famicom. It's one of my favorite consoles.
It's a really
so
nice
sleek.
Looking system. And the American
yeah.
version is just like – it's just over-designed.
It looks
kind
of like a Transformer character or something. It's going
yeah,
to
yeah, but like
a
from
car.
The bad part of Transformers yeah. after they stopped using die-cast metal. It's like it's like a Sharpticon.
I loved all the like the pre-release sort of chatter about that because it's like everybody sort of expected them to redesign it for America. It's like it wasn't – it would just seemed like such a foregone conclusion to like the media and stuff. It's like, well, when Nintendo announces the new version, the new redesign of it, then we'll see when it also comes out and America is like, what?
So,
no.
I do want to kind of step back a minute to where we were talking about Masayuki Uemura because I think like the decisions they made in terms of what's inside the Super NES, you were talking earlier about like what the Genesis aspired to do, what the Super NES aspired mm-hmm. to do. I think looking at the chips and the underpinnings, just the basic hardware inside is really telling for Sega and Nintendo's different, you know, respective approaches.
Yeah, I mean, the Genesis chip was sort of like an off-the-shelf kind of like all-purpose
chip. The Genesis chip was a 6800, a Motorola. It was the same thing that powered the Amiga. It was the same thing that powered the Macintosh. And most importantly, it was the same thing that powered a lot of arcade boards. It was a natural conversion like from arcades to Genesis. Sega said, let's make basically an arcade machine for our homes.
I didn't do a lot of research into the actual chips within the machine. Or were they proprietary, designed by Nintendo? I know the sound chip was designed by Sony.
So the Super NES chip is actually sort of like the next evolution of the chip inside the Famicom, NES. I can't remember what the name of the chip is.
It's like a RISC, whatever,
6502. No, it's not a RISC.
It's the 6502.
Okay.
And then the Famicom.
Right, yeah, in the Famicom, but then the Super NES is like the next evolution of that.
Right.
It's
basically proprietary. It was based on a thing, but
it's modified.
They took some things out that kind of hampered it, but it was their design.
But basically, they went. I've read that they went with that specific chip because it did have backward compatibility with the NES.
Yeah, that was planned.
And a big part of the plan was to make the system backward compatible. But then they dropped it because Nintendo always looks at hardware and says, "How can we make this inexpensive for the consumers?" And they said maybe supporting an old system is not essential. And they would figure out how to make backward compatibility possible later, like with the DS, to make it, not an added expense to the system.
Boy, did they get good at that.
Yeah. I mean, like the Wii giving us GameCube compatibility felt like a luxury or like a little gift.
Well, I mean, they use the same philosophy there. The GameCube processor, the joke was that two GameCube processors duct taped together.
Yeah.
No, that's true. It was. And the same thing for the Wii U. It's like it's these same families just expanded.
Like the PS2 sound chip was emulating PS1 or something crazy like that, right?
The I/O controller was a PS1 processor. It wasn't emulating. It was like the same chip.
Exactly, right.
Nintendo tried to do that with the Super NES, but I think they decided that having like an extra console port, for a cartridge was a needless expense. They could do that with Wii and with Wii U because you're using discs and like you put a disc into the disc drive and the disc drive takes it and there's no worry about pinouts or anything like that.
It's very weird. They didn't seem to really figure it out, so they just kind of abandoned it because in like 1988 they showed the Super Famicom and they also said this is what we're going to do with the Famicom as well. We're going to make a redesigned Famicom that is also going to be like an adapter for the Super Famicom. Play the old games, but that was abandoned, and then 2 years later.
It's so weird because a lot of these things they're going to be talking about are taking place in the late 80s. It feels so strange that this is a product of the late 80s instead of I associate this so much with the 90s. Of course it was in development before then, but this is just such the 90s console for me that it's weird that it goes back to 88,
Yeah, so I think, the choice to go with kind of like a system, a chip in the sort of the NES lineage had a big part in the Super Famicom, Super NES hardware being clocked really slowly. And that was a big drawback, especially for initial software, was that the chip was actually running at like half the speed of the Genesis chip. Yeah. But they, that also began sort of the argument that it's not pure processor speeds that makes the difference. They added a lot of extra functions and a lot of built-in capabilities.
More
to the
video
Super
RAM
NES.
And things like that.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, like the hardware mode functions and things like that. There were just lots of things like expanded color capabilities. The Genesis can have, 64 colors on screen and the Super NES is thousands.
Its palette is thousands,
but it can have hundreds at a time.
256, I believe.
Okay.
As opposed to like 64 in the Genesis, something like that.
Right. There's 64 on screen with Genesis, and I think it had a color palette of, I want to say, it might have been 256. It might have been like 120, 1024. Yeah. But anyway, it was like a greatly expanded palette of colors. Mm-hmm. And it had, the hardware modes. It had a lot of extra features that the Genesis didn't. So, right out of the gate, it could do things that the Genesis couldn't. But the Genesis could also do things that the Super NES couldn't. And so you had, like you were saying, like two systems that really spoke to different aspirations. Nintendo was not about arcade experiences, and the Super NES hardware reflects that. It can do really cool things, but super fast-paced games is really not one of them. You don't see a lot of like really intense action games. There were some, but you don't see a lot of them on Super NES.
I mean, Contra 3 was an early one, but
yeah,
it wasn't,
but I mean,
like,
even that's a pretty methodically paced game.
Like, compared to some of the treasure games that came out in Genesis, which felt like they were really frantic. And,
Yeah.
SNES music is good. There's a lot of really bad farty stuff, as farty as Genesis music could get. This is an 8-channel AD PCM audio chip designed by Ken Kutaragi of Sony fame. And what happened here was Kutaragi developed the chip because his daughter took a liking to the Famicom, and he's like, oh, these video games could be going somewhere. And his superiors at Sony wanted nothing to do with it. But I guess his mentor, who was the guy who helped make CDs happen, make them, you know, a thing that we all use or used to, he allowed him to develop this Super Famicom sound chip. And that's essentially where the partnership began in 1988 with Sony and Nintendo. That would eventually dissolve in a terrible way and eventually would create the PlayStation. We'll get to that later. But that's where the sound chip comes from, Ken Kutaragi. And it I mean, some of the best music in console gaming pre-Redbook audio was produced on the SNES. And it's so great to open an emulator and you can turn all those channels on and off individually and hear every instrument and just see how rich things like the Final Fantasy III music is.
So much slap bass.
Yeah.
So much slap bass.
Yeah.
The Super NES chip, the audio chip is crazy because the Super NES didn't have like wave synthesis. It didn't create bleeps and boops.
Right.
It couldn't do that. You could probably program the system to make those sounds, but that's not how the sound chip worked.
Is it all samples?
It is samples, okay. like sound fonts, and you can either I don't know if the system had them built in. I don't think it did.
I think Nintendo would provide you with a generic font library.
But like that had to be part of your cartridge.
Yeah.
Like, it didn't have that built in, but that was what the chip could do, was it could play those samples and create like sound fonts.
That's why, like, I think 8 megs of Earthbound's 24 megs is just the audio data because it's all the things that it's sampling.
Megabits,
by the way.
That soundtrack is huge, too.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't grow up with a Super Nintendo. I actually played Earthbound for the first time, just started it earlier this year.
Oh, awesome.
And it's rad, but that soundtrack is massive.
It's got to hold all those Beatles clips, you know?
That's right, yes. It's super funky, too. But it's also one thing I love about Super Nintendo games. Like, I love video game music in general. But it's just every game, like the Super Nintendo doesn't feel like it has like a unified sound, I think, because of that sampling compared to the Genesis,
it's more an atmosphere that unifies it. There is this kind of like scratchy, slightly distorted, you know, low speed sampling quality to it. So everything's a little bit fuzzy.
It's like a kind of a muffled, reverby kind of thing. Right. I don't know musical terminology.
And, you know, the developers that did use Nintendo's sort of... you know, they're just their like sample libraries. You do hear a lot of that slap bass, like it's like Seinfeld, the video game. But then, you know,
which would be awesome on Super NES because of that.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, Jerry did have a copy of SNES SimCity in his living room.
Yes,
that's been discovered.
But you know, developers who took the time to create their own sound images for the system could have games that sounded like nothing else.
Yeah.
Like, you know, Earthbound is the obvious example, but in Final Fantasy VI.
Dogs barking jingle bells, you could do that on the SNES. No one did, though.
So I feel like the Genesis is like the AC/DC concert. The Genesis is AC/DC, and like the Super NES is like the weird art installation at the museum you go to see, and you put on the headphones, and it's just
like a Philip Glass exhibit or something.
Yeah, it's like weird tweaks of orchestrated music.
Oh, sorry, Tim, did you have something to say?
Well, you said it was 8 out of 24 megs for Earthbound soundtrack.
Yeah, it was like a third of the cartridge space. Yeah.
How much of the cartridge space in Turtles in Time was dedicated to just orchestra hits?
Oh,
I'm curious.
Jeez. It was probably just the same hit, but orchestra hits were all over early 90s stuff. Yeah.
It was beautiful.
Mario Payne, you can just make a song out of all orchestra hits.
Yes.
Take down right. CNC Music Factory. they love that stuff.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's all on display in Mario Paint, too.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You have the full.
You can make your dogs barking jingle bells, of course, yeah. Finally. So let's go to the controller. We mentioned it briefly. Four more buttons on the NES, and this is a very important revolution in controllerdom in that it was a lot more ergonomic than what we were used to holding like a rectangular slab.
Yes.
And I feel like the labeling of the buttons X, Y, L, and R, they were there for the X and Y axes and whatever. But I feel like they were there to suggest the idea of 3D-ness and suggest the idea of futurism or whatever.
Yeah. They used to be A, B, C, D.
Oh, that's right. Okay, yeah. And what I really love is the Super Famicom, the splash of color where it's red, blue, green, and yellow. And you'll see that motif in a lot of games, but it's not reflected on the controller that you're holding at home with the muted purples. But I love that, and I also love how the A and B buttons are rounded and the X and Y buttons have little divots in them, which the Wii did not do with their classic controller, and they don't do with any of their controllers now, which I hate.
Pretty much just the American Super NES controller.
Oh, yeah, the Super Famicom one did not have that feature. That's right. I had an ASCII pad that did not do that. But what did you guys think of the controller when you first saw it? Because I was 9, to be fair, but I was like, oh my god, all these buttons. What can I do with these buttons? Even though they didn't use most of the buttons for the most part in the beginning. I mean,
right.
Somebody jump in here. I want to know what you think.
I was like, oh yeah, finally, we're in the future, more buttons. Because there were a lot of NES games that really needed more buttons. What was it? Batman, Sunsoft's Batman. There were some weapons. There was weapons that were mapped to the select button. That's not fun.
I mean, I love Mike Tyson's Punch-Out, but hitting start to throw an uppercut always felt weird to me.
It's kind of gross.
Yeah.
About hitting start, in fighting games on Genesis, for Street Fighter to switch between, punches and kicks. And having those shoulder buttons, I think, on the Super Nintendo always made me really jealous growing up of my friends
had
those extra buttons. I think.
Well. At least you weren't playing the PC version.
That's fair. one thing I loved specifically growing up playing a lot of platformers is the Super Nintendo controller is just so much more compact. I feel like the D-pad is less muddy than the Genesis D-pad, even though the Genesis controller was big and comfy. It was like a Cadillac, especially those first ones.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I don't like driving Cadillacs. It's too big.
And I think that's why, it's a beautiful world we live in where you can, play Sonic with a Super Nintendo controller if you want. It feels sacrilegious, but it is the better controller.
To be honest, I do a lot of emulation stuff, and regardless of what old console I'm emulating, I use my SNES USB controller because I love how it feels. It's got the divots in the buttons, and I can play NES games on that fine without having to freak out over, oh, there's no A and B or whatever, at least not in the place where it should be.
The Super NES controller has always been my favorite classic controller. I feel like it is kind of the gold standard of game controllers.
Because even Nintendo went back and recreated the NES controller, with a variant that was rounded and
dog bone kind of look, too.
Yeah. I mean, I think, they obviously realized this is way better than having, sharp corners dig into your palms.
And they finally made it a top loader after, I think that was a 1994 release or something that. 1993, really late. And I mean, I don't want to go over every tiny bit of detail, but the SNES would eventually be modified and re-released. And the final version looks a lot like a Super Famicom. It has the same colors as the SNES, but it's not as boxy.
It's the same shape.
Yeah, not
the same shape in Japan.
Doesn't have
the
rectangular protrusions that the original SNES one did. Yeah,
or the weird the wavy skirt.
That's weird.
That's actually the one that I know. The tiny little one, right? Yeah.
Were those in short supply or hard to find? I kind of want one, but
I remember it was packaged with Link to the Past, and it was $50.
Yeah, they bundled it 8 times.
Wow, so. Okay.
They still sell for $40-$50 just for the system, and they're worth getting because if you get the one that has the single chip variant, you have to open it up and see, but that one is capable of being modded to do RGB output. So
it's
the best possible video signal you can get from your Super NES. So that's what I use for doing my Game Boy capture.
Oh, so you have one
stuff.
Of those.
Yeah.
Cool. Okay.
Yeah, it's RGB modded and someone put a little purple light in it, which is pointless, but it outputs great video, it's beautiful.
So I guess you could conceivably play a Famicom game in an NES if you took it apart and shoved the ROM into the SNES, or did they not fit?
Famicom? Yeah. No, they have different pinouts.
Okay, I thought so.
There's a different number of pins on the chips, so you have to get an adapter.
So conceivably, you can play Super Famicom games on your Super Nintendo. The copy protection in this case is hard plastic tabs that are inside the little slot, and it will prevent a Super Famicom game from hitting the connectors.
Yeah, the carts are slightly differently shaped. NES is kind of like a rectangle if you look at it from the top, and then the edges are rounded.
Yeah.
Famicom is more
it's like a fingernail
kind of,
shape.
Yeah, yeah, it's got kind of like a half moon element to it. Yeah. So it can fit easily into the Super NES slot and vice versa. But it has these little tabs that are notches cut out in one system and not the other. But all you have to do is open up the flap on the Super NES hardware, the cartridge port, and take a needle nose plier and
wrench them out of there. I remember doing that because I got a copy of Rockman and Forte. And it's just like, well, I don't need to know Japanese to play this, you know, because it was Mega Man and Bass is what it was, and just wrenching those, feeling terrible, like I was committing some crime against my Super Nintendo. I'm like, please work.
And then, Dremel is more efficient. I recommend if you have one of those around the house, use that.
I was like 11.
So. Yeah,
fancy. It's like you're pulling out wisdom teeth or something.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm just lazy. Yeah.
So we're going to get into some minutiae here. And one thing I noticed is that the older cartridges are a lot fatter. They were designed so the SNES would lock them in when you hit the power. When you slid it on, it would like lock the cartridge in. But I feel like there was a danger in pulling a cartridge out that was being played because you're pulling on the guts of the system. So eventually they got rid of that and they made the system the cartridges gently slope inward. There was not that rectangular protrusion that the system would grab.
I hadn't noticed that.
Did Nintendo not give us a lot of credit in the U.S.? Because, I mean, the Game Boy locked in the cartridge when you turn on
that
power.
That kind of makes sense because you don't want your system to lose your game.
I mean, that's true. But the Nintendo, you
and
put
that,
your
that's also the Japanese. The Japanese Game Boy has that too.
It does. Okay, fair enough.
You'll probably remember this, Jeremy. SNES games used to come with these little cartridge
condoms. Of those just floating around.
Yeah, they stopped doing that when they redesigned the cartridges. Yeah.
Well, they're useless because you can't just like line your games up because you have these little bases for them, and so everything is like awkward.
They're
and
not practical, but I do think they're cute. They're like little shoes for
you
your cartridges to wear.
Okay, you guys all put those on your favorite games, right?
Oh, of course. Like, yeah. I was like, Earthbound.
No, I put them in a drawer and never touched them.
I was like, Earthbound, you didn't ship with one, but you deserve
those
one.
Those were like gold stars for my games, basically.
I remember that happened around 93, and I remember the first game I got that had that was Bubsy.
Oh, wow.
It's like, oh, they changed the cartridge.
Did it deserve
it? What could possibly go wrong? I'm done.
I'm a soft spot for Bubsy 1.
So I did want to dispel a myth that I think has been pretty well dispelled, but a lot of people still believe in it. They assume that if their SNES turns yellow, the SNES came out when a lot more people were smoking in America, and I think the general myth is like, oh, the smoking turned it yellow, but it was actually a type of fire retardant plastic that was made.
ABS plastic, yeah.
What's that, ABS plastic? So that yellowed at a faster rate, it oxidized or something like that, I believe. So
they didn't have the mixture right, so they added a chemical for the flame retardant stuff to the ABS plastic, but they didn't get the ratio right, so
I mean,
a lot of these early systems will yellow faster than some of the later.
Exactly. Ones. I mean, having worked at a GameStop, I realized things can turn yellow if people smoke too much, and it's disgusting. But this is a different thing. It's possible yours is yellow because your parents smoked or whatever. But in most cases, it is that ABS plastic that's been yellowing over time.
Yeah, and people have figured out like a formula you can use to apply to whiten up your system. But apparently, it makes the plastic really brittle. So I don't know that it's a good idea.
Yeah, Retrobite is what you're talking about.
Yeah,
it's basically it's extremely caustic. It's eating away layers of the plastic, which is not what you really want in the end.
So we talked about the backwards compatibility being on the table, and I feel like consumers had a real crisis about this because, I mean, in Japan and kind of in America as well by this point, we did have sequel systems, but this was the first, I feel like, real explicit sequel console where Master Drive to Genesis, you could be a consumer and be like, those are unrelated. Super Nintendo to
Nintendo. Yeah, but the thing is Genesis had an adapter you could buy to put the Mega Drive in.
That's true.
I mean, I think that
the Mega Drive – or the Master System games in there. And the Genesis actually used the Master System's controller as like its sound chip.
Right.
So
weird.
It's bizarre. And I think
they kind of did the same thing that Nintendo tried to do and did it more successfully.
There was precedent for that, Jeremy. I agree with you. But the market share of the Master System was so small that no one cared.
Oh, yeah.
NES, everyone had one. And I think it was assumed that like, oh, I'll play my old games on this. And if you watch – and we did this in our Nintendo Mania episode that caused some scandal on Retronauts 3 years ago. I will not talk about that. John Stossel's the devil. Also, but I do want to say that, there was a lot of consumer anxiety over this. Like, oh, the Japanese are ripping us off. Like, why can't I play my old games in this? Like, come on, Nintendo. This is a ripoff. But I feel like we weren't used to this cycle yet.
It was so crazy to me. I think we're going to need some people older than us to chime in because, like, I'm wondering, like – Was there as much of a firestorm about it over like the Atari 5800 or 5200, excuse me, compared
yeah.
to
Yeah. I mean, Tim, do you have any experience with this sort of response to Super Nintendo? I did see it a lot amongst parents. Luckily, my parents were I don't know if they were just wanted to spoil me or they maybe were tech savvy or they my dad played video games, so he knew like, oh, this is a better looking thing. But like, what was your experience?
Yeah, just anecdotally, I've done a lot of trying to go back and unpack my childhood to find out why I ended up with the Genesis and Master System instead of a Nintendo and Super Nintendo.
Yeah.
Talking to my mom about her, you know, Christmas shopping decisions and all that.
What were you thinking? How could you?
Just like,
you ruined me.
It's like, look at these images. Look at Mega Man X. Look at, there's this boss. There's mid bosses in
Wait,
this
Mega
one.
Man X? I thought it was Mega Man 10.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But trying to figure that out, a huge selling point in talking to my mom about this was that, yeah, you get this adapter. You can play the old games that we bought you, and they won't just collect dust somewhere, so you can still play your Alex kids and your Shinobi and stuff. And
I do remember those childhood sales pitches. You like pull your parents into a room, like, listen up, guys. Yep. I got a deal for you.
Right. And so it was, you know, I didn't choose that. I didn't choose a Genesis over a Super Nintendo. I was too young to make those decisions. But that I know that having some sort of backwards compatibility, you know, sold to my mom was a big value for the family, you know.
This is a good time to get into where we first met the Super Nintendo and when we fell in love with it. For me, I think I brought up in the past a few times that I went with the TurboGrafx-16 first because their marketing was just really effective. They were literally sending cassette tapes to my house and showing off like, oh, the system is so great. And it was also relatively affordable. It came with a few free games. It came with Bonk's Revenge. And I got that for my 10th birthday. But by the next Christmas, I really wanted a Super Nintendo. And thankfully, my parents were, interested in spoiling me. And I did. And I kind of just shoved my TurboGrafx-16 away forever. I think it was actually not functioning at that point. It didn't last very long. Jeremy, where did you encounter the Super Nintendo? Were you on board from the beginning, from like fuzzy pictures of Mario World and EGM?
I mean, I encountered it from the beginning in Nintendo Power. So,
oh, you're right.
Of course, I followed the hype and was like, yeah. The first time I ever actually played the system was in a PlayChoice 5, which was the 16-bit Super NES version of the PlayChoice 10.
No, no, that's had the Super System. Nintendo
Super,
Super System. Yes.
But it had 5 games, right? Not 10?
Yeah.
Not 10?
Just yeah. Wasn't called PlayChoice.
Yeah, okay. So I played Super Mario World and was like, ah, it's amazing. I know I talked about this on an episode before.
Right.
But yeah, I was totally on board.
That's those funny oversized gamepads. Sorry.
It took me like a year to save up enough money for it. But the first thing I bought with my first summer job's first paycheck was a Super NES. And I rented a whole lot of games after that.
I think all it took to convince me was playing the kiosk at a JCPenney or whatever and seeing Mario 1-1, Mario World 1-1, the big bullet bill. That's it. It's over. This is what I want in my life right now. And that's all basically all it took. I call it the shot heard around the world, I guess, in terms of the console wars, that giant bullet bill. Ray, where did you encounter the SNES? Were you immediately in love with it?
Yeah, like Jeremy said, Nintendo Power had like a little news bit that showed like the second early version of it with red buttons and everything. And then for the rest of 1990, all the other magazines were covering the import edition and just like, yeah, showing all the screens and stuff. It's like, oh, God, why can't I have like $300 to import this? until finally, like a year later, yeah, I finally got it pretty much at the launch period. Yeah, that late summer, fall. And then was cool in third grade for like a week.
And that would happen, Ray.
Right back to bullying.
Oh, sorry, Ray. But now you're on top.
I was the video game kid in school for all that year. So, it was great.
So it's time to talk about chips now. And much like the Nintendo and the Famicom, instead of investing in add-ons, which they almost did, we'll get to that soon, but instead of investing in add-ons and other expensive accessories, Nintendo did the same thing they did with the NES, and they were like, let's just put chips on that will, you know, aid in certain processes. They will make certain things happen. And for the most part, this was a very smart strategy, even though it made some games kind of expensive. And I think the most famous chips of these are the Super FX and the Super FX 2, mainly Star Fox and Yoshi's Island. And I mean, say what you want about that original Star Fox, but it was a very head-turning experience. That was considered inconceivable on a console, I think. Even if there were flight simulators and there were 3D games on PCs, that was a different world that we weren't necessarily in touch with. But seeing this happen, as primitive as it was an important move for Nintendo that they would double down on with Donkey Kong Country. Super FX games, guys, what do you think about them? Were you excited when you saw Star Fox's paper airplane flying across the screen and amongst a bunch of rectangles, I guess?
I think so. I participated in the Super Star Fox Weekend, which was sort of like their after launch period. It was like a tournament. They'd go to a store and they'd have this competition cartridge and you'd sign up and see who's the best scorer in the world or country. And I don't think I really beat the game originally, though. But it was fun. It's definitely exciting. I mean, the big comparison point magazines were making was like Silphied on Sega CD.
Oh, you're right, yeah.
And like I couldn't afford that at the time. So it's like, well, I'll stick with this then. Great.
I mean, I think Argonaut Software, it could have been a much more basic game, but I think they played enough with the idea of a 3D shooter that it wasn't just you in a blank space moving around. I love when they would make you zoom through these spaceships, sort of like much like – I mean, it was ripping off Star Wars a lot, but that was so cool, just like zooming through spaceships and things like that. And that one boss where you're fighting the core of the ship and you fly out of it after it explodes.
Yeah.
Like
little
touches like that. It looks hideous now, but I think it was very important for the Super Nintendo to flex its muscles when the Genesis was gaining ground on it. Jeremy, I feel like you had a lot of PC or Mac experience prior to this. This might have not been as visually interesting or as mind-blowing as it was for us. What did you think about Star Fox?
No, I mean, I didn't really have a lot of computer experience at that point. I got a computer a little after that and played Myst and Spectre and stuff like that. But Star Fox, I hadn't really seen anything like that before. It was really impressive. I hadn't played PC flight sims, and they wouldn't be interesting to me anyway. To me it was cool. I picked up the game as soon as I saw it on sale at Best Buy and enjoyed it for a while. I was kind of fading on my interest in video games at that point. Kind of went through like a little bit of a lull in my interest. It happens from time to time. So it kind of caught my attention and then I stopped playing it.
Bullet dodge there on the losing interest.
The Super FX chip was really impressive. I remember being having my mind blown by Star Fox. So where it really got me was I feel like platformers, like side-scrolling platformers are like this common language that we've known since like the 8-bit era, and you can point to certain consoles and what they bring to that formula with every generation. But like Super Castlevania 4, for example, and like having rotating levels and like sort of flipping certain conventions on their head or on their side.
Literally,
exactly. Whoa. Strap in, kids.
I mean, things like that were all functions the hardware could do natively. But you're right, Tim. I feel like it was important for them to put those out there, up front, even if the Castlevania level is gimmicky,
right?
Even if the Koopa sprite flying at the screen for no reason is gimmicky, it was like, here's a magic trick that won't interfere with gameplay too much.
Right.
Yeah. And we would see more stuff like that with the Super FX 2, which I feel like Yoshi's Island – allow me to go on my Yoshi's Island rant for like 40 minutes. But it is a crime, a national tragedy that this game is not available, has never been made available since its original release. I do not count the Game Boy Advance port. It's okay. It's not great. And I think we are being robbed as a people by not being able to play Yoshi's Island because
wow. –
Just the way this game looks, moves, plays, I feel like it is the logical conclusion to all of Nintendo's 2D platforming up to that point. And the things that the FX2 chip does with things that aren't 3D are amazing, like Touch Fuzzy Get Dizzy, obviously. But even the rudimentary 3D graphics in the game, they fit in kind of seamlessly with a 2D world because they don't go for things that are that ambitious. Those are mainly the two games, I think, that show off the chip. What am I thinking of? Ambitions or capabilities? Yeah.
I think Yoshi's Island is a better example for what I was trying to get to there before. Maybe you guys are have this amazing knowledge of the hardware and like the chipsets and stuff, and I am in awe of your computer brains. But
I have a lot of notes, by the way.
It's great. But the Bowser Jr. fight at the very end of Yoshi's Island.
Oh,
do you know how much that relied on that chip and just being able to pull off the scale of that?
I mean, I don't know specifically, but I think it would be impossible without it. I mean,
right.
The boss fights especially are just a showcase of technology, and they very rarely go to the wow, wowzers, this is 3D. It's more like this sprite's going to get huge, or I'm thinking of the Raphael the Raven fight, where it's like shades of Mario Galaxy 10 years earlier, where it's like you're going to be running around this moon and the sprites are scaling appropriately based on where you are. Yeah, I feel like every boss, they approach every boss like, what trick can we do? Like, what magic trick? Like, one is like it's going to split into a ton of enemies. Like, another one is like using transparencies in a fun way. I feel like they really gave it their all for this game, and it's so sad that my conspiracy theory is that Argonaut Software has some kind of patent on Super FX chip and its sequel, and they might have to pay money to re-release games that use that chip or a program to use the chip. That's just my conspiracy theory.
According to Dylan Cuthbert, in response to me on Twitter, that's not the case. He said there's no – he's not aware of any sort of licensing restrictions.
That's weird. Okay.
It was just a Twitter exchange.
I'm not calling him a liar, but it's very conspicuous. Would you say call this very conspicuous that this game has never been re-released on virtual console?
It could just be something that's too difficult and expensive to properly emulate.
I don't buy that either, but
it's not – like coming up with emulation for something like that is not a trivial – matter.
I agree, but I mean,
it's not like they can just do it for free.
I know, but I mean, teenagers figured it out like 15 years ago.
Yeah, but they have time and they're not paid.
That's true.
And,
teenagers. They're adults now.
Nintendo doesn't do like emulation stuff unless it meets their exacting standards. I don't understand why those standards include making, NES games on Wii U look really dark and muddy.
Yes.
But for the most part, when Nintendo releases something, on Virtual Console or whatever, it's pretty much impeccable. It's really, really good.
Let's get M2 on a Yoshi's Island port.
Yeah, I think they're tied up with Sega though. But I mean,
those bastards.
I don't know. I really feel like it's just a resource issue.
Mm, yeah.
Nintendo doesn't want to just, half-ass it.
It's possible, but you're right, Jeremy. I think it could be like this would cost more money than we would take in reselling Yoshi's Island. But
there's a dozen games that use FX technology.
Yeah.
And let me name drop one game, Stunt Race FX.
All right.
Yes. I'm okay.
Vortex.
It does run at 10 frames per second.
But I loved it.
In 40% of the screen.
Yeah.
But that game has great music, a lot of character based on just the faces of cars, the weird faces of cars they make. And I feel like that could have been made a sequel on N64 or something. But that was like a last ditch final use of the FX2 chip, I think.
No, it was FX1.
Oh, that was still FX1.
It was like how many Star games Fox? Actually wow. had the FX2 chip in them?
Two, three.
Which one?
One of which only came out in Europe, which is like an Olympics game.
Oh, yeah?
Winter games.
I didn't even know about that one.
So was that in Doom?
Yeah, okay. Doom was FX2. Yeah. I own all the FX chip games that were released in America, but they're just in a pile. I haven't really messed with them. I just wanted to get them because they'll never be on virtual console. Yeah. So I was like, I want to be able to play these games even if they're not any good, just, for archival purposes.
There's something very cool about that blood red Doom cartridge.
Oh, yeah.
Sticking
the Doom
out.
Cartridge, that and Maximum Carnage.
I was going to say, it's the one good red cartridge that you can have. Is Killer Instinct a black cartridge? I'm trying to think of the many variants. Yeah. Mm.
Maximum Carnage was red also.
Mm. Killer Instinct, speaking of video game music before, woof.
Killer really Combos?
Good. Yeah.
Was that the name of the
Killer Cuts?
Killer Cuts.
Killer Cuts, yeah.
Oh, they just released that on vinyl. I didn't buy a copy.
Wow. Yeah, I'm sure there was a lot of orchestra hits in that one as well. So let's move on to other chips. This gets very arcane and granular, but we have the DSP chip, which I think assists with scaling and moving graphics around in a way that SNES can't natively. There are four different versions. Two, three, and four are used for one game each, I believe. So there are very specific chips that are only used for just one game, which I find amazing. And a lot of these are just Japanese release. I have here DSP-1 was used for scaling and rotation, so that's how we got Mario Kart for SNES. I believe F-Zero was not using this chip, but Mario Kart had more racers, more things happening on the screen. And it actually had that rear view mirror mode too. So there's a lot to keep track of in
and
Mario
the split
Kart.
Split screen in general.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I just listed some more chips, or just actually games that use chips. So some examples of games that use chips are Mortal Kombat, Falcon's Revenge, F1, ROC2, Race of Champions and Mega Man X2 and X3. So there aren't like a huge amount of games that use the chips. I believe Mega Man X2 and X3 have like these weird rudimentary polygon enemies.
Yeah,
Like
the chips basically just allow some like very simplistic polygonal graphics to happen. Yeah.
And they also
Really strange is that Capcom took the time to do Virtual Console emulation on those.
That's true, yeah. And also, I mean,
like, I never expected those games to come out, and thank God they did, because X3, like just a cartridge now, sells for like $300.
I'm sure ridiculous. The chip. I mean, I'm sure the chip made it so they didn't produce as many, you know, because they had to pay for the production of
probably.
The carts.
The Japanese version is still pretty cheap, though.
Yeah,
like $40.
But I mean, DSP, Nintendo did bring out Mario Kart on Virtual Console, so obviously they know how to emulate the DSP chip. Is there anything else I'm neglecting to mention in terms of chips? I think I hit them all.
There's nothing that big, really. I think you hit it all. Yeah. The next impressive one to the Super FX was the Capcom ones, yeah.
I think the Super FX does stand out, though, because it is the one that it was actually marketed to consumers. Like, the Super FX games are going to change, and here's how. And I feel like it wasn't just called the Mario chip originally, I think.
Yeah.
That's what it stood for.
It was like Mario, the O in Mario was a zero.
Okay, so instead of giving it like the DSP, they gave it like market this kind of names. And I think that was important in selling the technology or at least like getting people to be interested in technology at least.
Yeah. It was real blast processing.
Yes, something that really existed.
The thing about add-on chips is that for Super NES, they didn't play the essential role that they had on NES. Pretty much any game worth playing after 1986 relies on some sort of special memory map.
Yeah, like any game with a status bar needs like like Mario 3 with a static like section of the screen that's not moving that has its own graphics.
The fundamental hardware for the NES was so limited that in order to have anything more complicated than Super Mario Brothers, you needed to have a special add-on chip. Whereas Super NES didn't have that limitation. You didn't need like an advanced memory mapper chip to trick the processor into thinking, oh, this is actually multiple games in one or something.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't dicking around with memory at the system level the way you had to with NES. So, yeah, there are some kind of cool chips on Super NES, the FX2 and so forth, but not nearly as many arcane, fascinating chips, I think, as the NES, or actually the Famicom especially. Like, to me, that is just amazing. I love learning and reading about those because they did so much beyond what the hardware was ever intended to do. And certainly the FX chip enabled something that the Super NES could not have done on its own. I mean, with a 3 megahertz processor doing 3D graphics, no, that's impossible. But I don't know. Like they just served a different function. It was more like crazy high-level enhancements as opposed to like low-level essentials.
Yeah, I believe Tales of Phantasia and Star Ocean, some of the last huge RPGs for the system that were not released here, had special chips in order to increase memory. I think at least Star Ocean had an entire opening song in Japanese.
Yeah,
so,
they also, like, Star Ocean, I know, had super compressed data.
Mm,
it had a real-time decoder in it.
It took people a long time to translate it.
I think Street Fighter Alpha 2 also had all kinds of compression going on because it was just like, you know, here's a game that people are playing on Saturn and let's make a pretty decent version of it on Super NES. What? That's crazy.
So
that game amazed me.
Which one?
Street Fighter Alpha 2, Super NES version.
Yeah.
Like, I was really surprised. A roommate of mine bought it and I was like, wow, I didn't realize the system could do that.
Rare cartridge game with loading.
Yes.
Okay, we are back, and I hope you enjoyed that little announcement I threw in there. And I was going to talk about accessories, but then I realized that Ray did an entire episode about SNES accessories, so you can go listen to that. That's at Retronauts Pocket number 9 from 2013. I assume it still holds up.
But, I assume so. You haven't made any new accessories.
No, not yet.
The HD Retrovision.
Yeah.
Sure.
But maybe we could talk about does anyone have a favorite? I think mine, just this is weird, but I do like the mouse a lot, even though I used it only for one game. It made me feel like a young professional, like I've got a mouse for my gaming system. Like, yeah. Ooh la la, I'm going to clean my mouse now. And I used that mouse cleaner until mice became laser mice, and then I got rid of it. So up until like maybe the early 2000s, I was using that Nintendo mouse cleaner. It was
you
so
can still
perfect.
Clean the grooves on the scroll wheel.
Even just being true. Empowered with the knowledge that you can clean a mouse is important because, yeah. Boy, I remember the first time I discovered that.
And Nintendo gave you the power.
That's right.
Ray or Tim, how about you? Do you have a favorite accessory? Because, again, we covered everything, the Super Game Boy included, I believe.
Yeah. I mean, Super Game Boy is it. I feel like it's a kind of a cop-out answer, but man,
oh, no.
Like it was perfect for what I wanted out of that system. You know, we were talking about backwards compatibility, and I think I kind of forgot about the Super Game Boy, but I played so many Game Boy games.
Me
on
too.
That, yeah.
Even though I didn't need to. It just was such a novelty that I loved it. Yeah. So, Jeremy, would that be yours as well?
I mean, Super Game Boy is the most important accessory in the history of video games.
Mm.
I say this as a person
to you.
who does a weekly video series involving video captured directly from a Super Game Boy. So, yeah. That's made my life better. It's amazing. And I owned one back in the day. I didn't have a Game Boy, but I did get a Super Game Boy. So that let me play stuff like A Link to the Past – or sorry, Link's Awakening, Metroid 2, Final Fantasy Adventure, like all these great games that I would have missed otherwise. So, yeah, that's just a fantastic accessory.
And Ray, how about you?
Yeah, Super Game Boy, I suppose. Yeah. I was hyped for that almost as much as the Super NES.
Mine is secretly Super Game Boy as well. I mean, I had that mouse. I did have a lot of fun with it, but I mean...
The mouse has a lot of charm, but the real killer app, Mario and Wario, did not come out.
I know, exactly.
God damn it. I mean, it was a Game Freak game. Come on. They make good stuff.
Yeah. It's true.
So our next topic is the SNES CD, and Ray seemed to take a certain liking to this topic. So like everyone in the 90s, Nintendo wanted to jump on the multimedia bandwagon, but their attempts led to a lot of drama. And we talked about how Ken Kutaragi designed the sound chip. So in 1988, that happened, and that kind of sealed the deal between Sony and Nintendo. Like, we want to work together. Let's sign a contract to produce a CD-based add-on. So this contract apparently was signed in 1988, according to my research, which I find strange. Again, I feel like Super Nintendo is such a 90s thing, but they were spearheading this thing in the late 80s.
Yeah.
So CES 1991, and Ray, if there are more details, please jump in. This is just sort of like the broad overview because there's a lot of drama. There's a lot of infighting. But at CES 1991, which is the Consumer Electronics Show, Sony introduces –
You've seen one. You've seen them all.
Yes, exactly. Sony introduces a standalone console called the PlayStation. Two words, PlayStation. Which would play standard SNES games as well as a new CD-ROM format. So essentially, licensing issues sunk the PlayStation. Sony would control the means of SNES CD licensing and production, not Nintendo. And they would have the power of licensing rights. Nintendo made a mint in the NES era, of course, by being in charge of the means of production. Like, you had to pay Nintendo to make cartridges.
You're very, like... getting kind of communist there.
What?
Very Marxist.
No, I mean...
the means of production.
I mean, that is literally the means of production,
isn't it? Take it back, proletarians.
Yes, cast off your chains and make those carts yourself. But no, essentially, I mean, like... Nintendo, at the behest of Yamauchi, the president at the time, they were cutthroat business people. I mean, there was a reason why they were on top, not just because of the quality of their games, but because of their ruthless business practices. And one of those, of course, was like, if you make games, you make them through us. And if you don't, we will find you and kill you, Tengen. I'm looking at you. And they wanted to keep this deal up. And that is sort of why I think a lot of the reason why they stuck with the N64, not just because of the tech advantages, there were few, but because, again, we want that cartridge money. We want to make the cartridge.
Yeah, you can get a dollar plus out of those.
Exactly. So literally a day after the PlayStation is revealed at CES 1991, there are some backdoor shenanigans and Nintendo announces a new partnership with Philips. Minoru Arakawa.
Minoru.
His voice is like a tongue. His name is a tongue twister for me. He pulled some strings quickly with like European friends in order to make this happen. So literally a day after they announced the PlayStation, the Sony branded Nintendo add-on console that would play SNES titles.
Literally the day after Sony announced that.
Exactly.
Not Nintendo.
Exactly. So a day after, Nintendo's like, nuh-uh. We're going to partner with Philips. And this obviously caused a huge split. I guess...
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. Ray, go ahead. I mean... There's got to be more to this.
It was a big hardware split, yes, but Sony ImageSoft, which was their game company at the time, still existed, and they still made Super NES games.
Yeah, Sony's divisions, like their hands have no idea what the other hand is doing.
Exactly. Yeah,
and it's a weird little business. I think it's important to note that Philips is the other company besides Sony that was responsible for the creation of the CD format. So yeah, Nintendo went from basically like one papa to the other papa.
Exactly, exactly. One that would give them or let them make more money.
Yeah, basically.
And I want to live in that timeline where the PlayStation actually came out.
It's probably not too far from our own planet.
Yes, exactly. I want to jump to that. I want to quantum leap into somebody's body and experience that. But so what happened was there was still like a contract signed on paper like, oh, we can't back out of this. So they had to negotiate a deal. And Sony was allowed to produce Nintendo-compatible hardware, but Sony was like, no, we're going to hold on to this for the next generation, and that's essentially how the PlayStation was born. I mean, this is a very – I think the story is very well known by now, but I'm sure there are some people who don't know it. The main problem was lots of games were in development for the SNES CD at the time this deal had ended, and they had to be altered as a result. Some notable examples I wrote down here are Secret of Mana. We don't know what was cut from that game, I don't think, but obviously the way the game flows, there are some things missing.
It feels very, very glitchy.
Yes.
Like they didn't – I don't know, just like things were taken out and left holes and gaps. Mm-hmm. And it just feels kind of incomplete. It's a great game, but it definitely suffered somehow.
Were there going to be more controller inputs on, you know, the final hardware?
Probably not.
To enable three players? Okay.
Yeah. Gotcha.
No, I mean I've touched a Sony PlayStation, and it's pretty much the same thing as a Super NES, but with like the hardware, you know, the diskette or the CD-ROM bay underneath.
And it's funny, this caused a lot of delays with some games. One I could find, and it's one game I enjoy, Marvelous Another Treasure Island, which is an SNES action Zelda-y game. Came out in 1996, directed by Eiji Aonuma, thank you. This game apparently was in development as early as the early 90s. It was meant to have anime cutscenes starring a different character, but it was eventually reworked, put on the back burner, and in 1996 it eventually released in its current form, which is great. I recommend you play that.
There were several games, like, you know, ports of PC CD-ROM games that were shown off and announced. Was it Seventh Guest?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, and Nintendo Power. They were like, get ready for multimedia. Well, this shit's happening, bro.
Blood happening.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Those were just cut altogether.
Yes, exactly. And
was Nosferatu supposed to be a CD-ROM game, or was that one just delayed for some
other
reason?
Just delayed.
Yeah, okay. That was in the back of...
That was going to be like a launch game.
Whatever that SNES guide that Nintendo Power put out alongside the launch was essentially like a sales brochure / strategy guide. Nosferatu was in the back. Mm-hmm. When did that game come out eventually?
95.
95,
yeah, it was
wow.
really late.
God, it was like a Prince of Persia-ish kind of thing? Yeah, I thought so. So even if Nintendo promised an SNES CD in the pages of Nintendo Power, it never came to pass. But unfortunately, fortunately for us in the future, we can laugh at it. Philips had the right to produce their own games for the CDI based on Nintendo characters. And we are all still laughing at those Zelda cutscenes, which are all available on the internet. Please look them up if you haven't.
Don't forget Hotel Mario either.
Yes, exactly.
If you need help on playing the game, check the instruction manual.
Wow, Ray, were you getting voice work 20 years ago?
I studied him well.
Awesome.
I was understudy.
Yes. These games would not tarnish the brand of Zelda or Mario. I feel like the CDI was such an overpriced, strange, weird, edutainment-y, a bizarre thing that it didn't reach enough people to have people be put off by Zelda and Mario in these formats.
No.
And that's essentially the story of the SNES CD. It became the PlayStation, and then the PlayStation would eventually gain dominance for like a decade before the Wii kind of sunk Sony for a bit. What did I miss anything here? Do you guys have any commentary on this? I find this so fascinating.
I just think it's such an incredibly speedy timeline. I don't think, you know, none of the significant stuff really got made until the 90s, regardless of what you say about 88 and stuff. So, like, we're talking about a period of, like, 3 or 4 years until the real PlayStation showed up. And it's like, that's not a lot of time to like develop and plan and then manufacture a whole new game console. So for like that switchover from like Nintendo to like Sony going on their own is like crazy to me. And I mean, it's just it's also like at the same time, multimedia is booming relatively. I mean, and we have new players like 3DO also jumping in and becoming like a new game console as well. So it's like, it's just crazy to me that all that happened in such a compressed period of time, and then Nintendo just kind of like bailed.
Maybe Sony being spurned is what made them put their full force behind this, because I feel like...
I don't
like,
doubt it, but yeah, it's just crazy.
I feel like with more with Japanese business, this could be a stereotype. I'm sorry if you think it is or if it actually is, but I feel like there's more of a more like honor at stake. And the move they made felt like a very cutthroat, like American kind of thing. Even though they were very cutthroat in Japan as well. But I feel like there was a certain kind of honor loss there between Sony
Japanese,
and Nintendo.
Japanese businesses revolve very heavily around relations.
Yeah.
Like, anytime that I've made connections in Japan, it's always not always, but generally because someone I know or someone I work with, like you know. Whoever, PR or whatever, has taken the trouble to kind of introduce me to the Japanese side of people and like to familiarize them with me so that then they're like, okay, this person is, you know, part of our circle and we trust this person, so we'll let them, you know, have access or whatever.
Yeah.
Like that is just very much like relationships, handshakes, getting to know people. That's really key to Japanese business. That's not a stereotype. It's a fact.
Yeah, yeah.
And yeah, what Nintendo did with Philips was very much in defiance of that, which is really strange because Nintendo is in so many ways such a traditional Japanese company.
Yes.
Much more so than I would say any other company in the games business.
But NOA had a lot of power because, you know, that's why apparently Arakawa and Lincoln led this Philips thing, because, you know, they still had a lot of power. And also they got Tetris for one thing before
that. Yeah, that's
true. So, I mean – And you know, the Mario and Zelda games on CDI are basically like offshoots of the cartoons. Like, they're using that as their model. So that's why they're kind of crappy, and those were American-led things. I think, like, you know, they had a bit more power back then.
So, Tim, what was your take on the SNES CD when it was being previewed? I mean, did you have an SNES by this point? Were you like, I'll have my Sega CD, thank you. It can play Sewer Shark, and I can make a music video. Like, I'm just curious.
That's the thing is, like, in retrospect, I would love to live through a timeline where this did happen and see how it shook out. But I'm happy that it didn't, because I remember being, you know, a Genesis kid and not being interested in the 32X, being interested in the Sega CD, and being so fundamentally confused about how these things tied into, you know, the systems I already had. I understood an adapter to let me play Master System games. It plugs on the top. I can put this in. It's like putting a different nozzle on a garden hose or something. That, for some reason, that made sense to me. But then these add-ons and what they brought to the table was so confusing as you know, a younger consumer that I'm glad that that the Nintendo waters didn't really get muddied by that add-on part of it, because Nintendo, to me, something I love about it, and you know, as an example of this is like the more recently, you know, announced mini NES Classic, I think is what it's called, where it has like the 30 games in it. It's just like this little tailored, you know, curated device that is simple and accessible, and I think that adding on an add-on would have just been a confusing mess.
Yeah, I mean, I don't
think... It already was.
Right. I don't think I don't think consumers are necessarily like stupid or ignorant, but they want to be comfortable with a purchase. They don't want there to be confusion. So I feel like...
Oh, man.
Like, even naming something a Wii U is too confusing for a consumer. And when it seems relatively straightforward, or even like adding a number to something is confusing to a consumer. So yes, having the SNES CD, the Sega CD, the Sega 32X, like, those do not help a consumer be like, I'm making a good purchase.
I mean,
you know?
We talk about that parental uproar about there just being a Super Nintendo.
Yeah.
Imagine if, you know, they had the choice of the add-on CD drive or the dedicated CD console that also played Super NES games. Mm-hmm. Like,
it's actually, you know, it's interesting. I wonder if we're going to be getting into that now, you know, with you know, the new Xbox
Scorpio
and stuff
and
like that.
It
might be it's like a different version of those conversations. But I think that people are way more adept at describing advantages now.
I think
I may have written an editorial making that comparison.
Oh, really? Yeah. I'm gonna have to hunt that down.
It's great. It's on usgamer.net.
Not everyone has the motivation to do this, but I feel like the information is out there. You can just do a search on Google, like, what is this? You couldn't do that in a store. You could ask a guy, but he could just be trying to sell you something. You know, you can't really trust the salesperson at all times. So,
well, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the fact that the CD, you know, resurfaced. recently.
Yes, I did want to mention
there
that.
Were prototype things that sort of floated around in circles, and you can see photos of like really weird controllers and stuff that were sort of like, you know, that were vacillating between the Super NES and the real PlayStation. But then, you know, recently we got something that was seemed to be more closer to the final system. It was all because some guy found it in an attic.
Apparently, there were – this could be traced back to Olaf Olafsson.
Yes. Yep. So Olaf Olafsson –
the guy with the coolest name in the universe, yes. By the way. Yeah.
He was the head of Sony ImageSoft.
Yes, that's
which
right.
Was the game company. God, and then later, Sony Computer Entertainment when PlayStation stuff's gone. And then he – you know, after that all ended, he was, you know, going around building his career. He ended up at a place called Advanta, which was like a financial company, I think. And then they went bankrupt basically. And they had like a company auction of some assets and stuff. And apparently Olaf Olafsson had a prototype a Super Nintendo PlayStation, fairly functional, but didn't take it with him when the company went under. And so it ended up in this auction and then in the hands of a guy who used to work at the company, like a maintenance man, Terry Diebold. Mm. And then he just kept it up in the attic for, you know, 6 or 7 years. And then his son comes over for the holiday or whatever, finds it in the attic, and then just shows it off on Reddit, basically. This guy's a little bit younger than us, so he doesn't fully know what this thing is. But everybody else on the internet is like, holy
freaking out. upvote.
Yeah. Upvote. And then sell. Like, of course you should sell this.
Yeah.
But yeah, it apparently – and I – it was a fully functional – not fully functional. Excuse me. Partially functional because it did play Super NES games. It does boot those up. And yeah. It also comes with a BIOS cartridge for the CD drive, much like you would – no, never mind.
But kind of like the PC Engine system cards.
I was thinking Sega. Excuse me. Yeah, something like that.
There was no software uncovered for
games. Right. But the boot cartridge was dumped, and you can kind of see a prototype BIOS boot
of the UI or just like the actual.
A very rudimentary,
like some options and stuff.
Yeah, okay, it's like a text based UI, but it yeah. It
yeah, would, and I actually was
you've touched it.
Yeah, I was gonna say
I touched it.
No, back at
never wash those hands again.
That's right. Kind of stinky. Back at
by the way, it was yellowed.
It was yellowed?
Yes.
Oh wow.
Yeah. In plastic. What the hell was Milwaukee?
Midwest
Gaming
Classic.
Expo.
Yeah,
Gaming Classic. Yes. I kind of emceed for a public presentation of that. And I think the system was a little worse for the wear because it wouldn't actually output video. Apparently, they just had – I haven't had a chance to watch the video yet, but Ben Heckendorn, the guy who does all those amazing like modded systems and hacks and things like that, took it apart and I think got it working again and talked about the workings of it, like what's inside and really kind of broke it down. So I'm looking forward to watching that.
I skimmed through it silently. I didn't have audio on it, but there was like a specs comparison. And you can see, like, in terms of raw numbers, things like megahertz and RAM size and stuff, it probably would have outdone the Sega CD. Of course, it's like the actual systems themselves. It does some things better and some things worse. But I think, yeah, it probably would have done some cool things that the Sega CD couldn't have done. Who knows what?
I assume there has to be software for it somewhere out there, maybe in someone else's attic. God knows if that one prototype could play it. But there should be another prototype. I mean, it has to exist somewhere. Am I just crazy?
I wouldn't doubt it. I mean, like I said, there was some other weird prototype that didn't look anything like this one. It was like a big gray charcoal gray brick thing. But the thing about this newer one is that there was photographic evidence of it. It had shown up in like a book about Sony industrial design or something like
that. You're right, yeah.
So that's why people recognized it and were like, holy shit, you need this. But
functionally the machine is basically like a Super Famicom mounted to
it looks like a washer dryer unit kind
of. Yeah, I mean, you would see, a good comparison would be the Famicom Disk System.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay. Or even better, the Nintendo 64 DD.
Oh, yeah.
Which we'll talk about in the 64.
They did not.
In 64 episode.
Yeah.
That's, it's like kind of an all-in-one. It uses standard Super NES controllers. The controllers that came with it say like PlayStation on it, but they are Super Famicom controllers, and it's interchangeable. You can use like regular Super Famicom controllers. It boots up regular Super Famicom games.
And again, it blows my mind how close it got. We could have had it.
Yeah. Apparently, they produced 200 of those units.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they were all recalled and destroyed, but Olaf Olafsson, I guess, was just like, no, it's my desk accessory.
That's
or whatever.
Sneaky devil.
Thank God.
Yes.
So, you know, stuff like that happens all the time.
He hasn't shown up at all since. We haven't heard a peep from him.
he's been silenced.
Apparently the Diebolds reached out to him, and he just hasn't said anything. Yeah. So, who knows?
That's awfully suspicious.
Yeah, it's perhaps ominous.
Yes. Yamauchi isn't dead. He's an assassin now. Yeah.
Goodness, yeah.
So we need to move on to Console Wars, covered in the book Console Wars, of course, but also the real thing that happened in the 90s. And what happened was I think Nintendo, being a very Japanese company, was not prepared for the brazen assault against them launched mainly by Sega of America, which Sega of Japan was not very happy with. I mean, if you read the book, and there's a lot of great information in the book, even if you don't like how the story is told, there's still a lot of great information in the book, by the way. But like, they directly attacked Nintendo, and that was something that, like, oh, I can't believe you did that. And on the other hand, Nintendo had a policy of never acknowledging their competition. Like, if you listen to our Nintendo Mania episode from 3 years ago, we listened to I believe a 2020 piece about the NES. You'll notice that there is no mention of any other system. The Genesis existed, so I feel like Nintendo was like, if we're going to work with you, we are the only thing that exists. And we did episodes on GamePro TV and Nick Arcade, and on those, there are Nintendo games, but Nintendo published games are not on those shows. So I feel that, like, we will only work with you if we are the only game in town. And that was their sort of strategy in terms of dealing with the media. But they were not used to having to actually respond to competitors saying, you know, screw these people, like, we're better.
Yeah.
And that's essentially what started the console wars in general. Just Sega being like, you're the giants, we're taking you down. We're first to the market with a 16-bit console, and we developed this guy named Sonic the Hedgehog, which is way better than Mario. Not really, but it's still impressive if you're a kid in 1991 and think Mario's kind of fat and lame and Sonic is totally badass.
I mean, it worked on me. Like, Sonic the Hedgehog is the reason I'm sitting here.
It almost worked on me, to be fair. Like, I had a TurboGrafx-16 and I got an SNES for the December of 1991 Christmas, or 1992 rather, and I was really eyeing Sonic. I'm like, could he be cooler than Mario? I mean, like, what was your take on it, Tim? Like, how did you view Sonic the Hedgehog?
I mean, it was mind-blowing. Like, at the time, it was, you know, our family got a Genesis when it was repackaged with Sonic in 91, right? Then that was what drew me in. You know, it was as colorful as, you know, Super Mario World in my eyes. Like, it was rivaling those, that feel, but it definitely had like a different edge to it, I feel like, just slightly. Mm-hmm. Sonic's idle animation, right? Like, yeah. This guy's got he has an attitude. You know, Mario, as much as I love him, like, he was kind of a cipher at the time.
The graphics are hipper, the music is hipper.
Oh yeah, it's great.
For as much as I love Mario World, it is kind of a game that I like how it looks, but it is sort of a plain looking game in terms of what they could have done with Mario's animations and with, like, things moving in the background and things like that. Like, Sonic is just a very beautiful game to look at. I don't like how it plays nearly as much, but it is very upfront, like, very pretty.
Yeah, I, you know, ended up buying a Super NES. I was well aware of Sonic at that point. I'd borrowed a friend's Genesis. He had Sonic. And I loved the way Sonic looked and sounded. I liked, you know, the gameplay, but it didn't have enough substance for me. Like, Super Mario World really hit the spot that I wanted. Like, that's my, you know, I like that better than Super Mario Brothers 3. Let the debate rage forever. but I was kind of embarrassed to like Mario. Like, the marketing definitely had its hooks, and I was like, oh, Mario's kind of lame and boring, but I like this game. It's really good. I can't stop playing it. I want to find all 96 exits. Well, and then so, you know, eventually, you know, the play of the thing trumped out for me over the visuals and the sound. But I can't deny Sonic's appeal.
Yeah.
But ultimately, like, I felt like if I was going to spend money, I wanted something that I could really sink my teeth into. And I just knew from history that Super NES would give me that experience.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't convinced by Sonic because I played a lot of it at a friend's house. And I was like, oh, I can play through this game in like half an hour, and you don't go back to levels. And I love Super Mario World a lot more, so that kind of convinced
me. You gotta get all the
me.
Chaos Emeralds.
That was too hard, right? I could get all the exits in Mario World. I could
not
get all the Chaos Emeralds.
Not as hard as 96 exits.
For some reason, that's not hard for me. But
getting all the Chaos Emeralds in 2 is way harder than it was.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Especially if you're playing with Tails. He's a mess. Yes. But, I mean, like, the Genesis definitely had more grit, I feel like, at least aesthetically. You know, you had Streets of Rage and Altered Beast and stuff, and these just felt darker. I think they were literally darker than, you know, stuff like Mario World. But, but also it had that tone to it. I don't know. Growing up, looking back, and, like, the way people remember console wars, and I feel like I grew up in an era that would have been, you know, ripe for that. But I just always had the attitude, and I think this has followed me till today, is just like, well, why don't – let's just have all these things. Let's just play everything. This is great. It's wonderful that these things have totally different libraries and sort of, you know, even similar games. You guys talked about Aladdin recently and the differences between, you know, the Genesis and the Super Nintendo one that was made by Capcom. I just love that you could have it all. So the – the sort of opposition, the clash, it never really resonated with
me. Yeah, I mean, I don't think I ever internalized it and made it into this tribal sort of thing where it's like, you've got a Genesis,
no.
I hate you. It was more like, I prefer the Super Nintendo. I like how these games look and sound and play better, but my friend has a Genesis. I'll go over to his house, play all the games I can't play, and they're fine. I'm not going to ask my parents for this. I'd rather have more SNES games, but these things can coexist. Mm-hmm. And that was my attitude. I mean,
we should have gotten Kohler on this episode because he still has that console war internalized.
He was giving kids swirlies in fifth grade, like, say Mario's better.
Jeremy, what you said actually just made me think of like the idea of going from Super Mario World and, you know, having that be sort of your core platformer for the series on Super Nintendo and going over and checking out Sonic and playing around with it. Like, I think that leap would be way harder than, you know, for me growing up and playing a lot of Sonic and then, like, looking at Mario and being like, oh, but this is platforming. You know what I mean? Like, it would be harder to go back, I think.
Mm.
For sure. Because Super Mario World is, like, the best side-scrolling platform that's ever been made. So.
And wow. I thought I had good things to say about
more
it.
More hammers dropped.
So Sega really, I mean, part of – the only way I took this personally was when Sega would openly insult you if you liked Game Boy or openly insult you if you like Super Nintendo games. Like, why would you want to play Mario Kart when you can play – what are they comparing it to? I forget.
Sonic.
Really?
I think.
Yeah. I mean,
not another racing game.
There was a lot of disingenuous advertising. I mean, that's the point of advertising. But in this case, it was like, we've got Blast Processing, which really doesn't exist. Of course, we've talked about that before. But they were just convinced with showing you, like, we are cool. We are cutting edge. The SNES is slow and dorky, full of these colorful games for losers. And we're totally badass and ready for the go-go 90s. And Nintendo eventually tried to combat this, Nintendo of America at least. They're like, you think you've got it going, buddy. We're going to do this our own way. And they launched the
Yoshi's Island makes fat people explode.
Exactly. the Play It Loud campaign, which has some great commercials. And it's like Nintendo really wanted to be as edgy as Sega but couldn't quite do it and didn't really fit their image, I feel like. There is a commercial out there with the Butthole Surfer song in it advertising Nintendo games.
That
and
was
they bleep,
the one.
They
Nintendo's bleep. 90s ads are the epitome of...
They're so 90s. I love
What's
them.
Up, fellow kids?
Or yes. I sure love those
How
damn video games. Yeah.
From my perspective, I think they worked for that first year they did it, which was, you know, Mortal Kombat 2 and Donkey Kong Country. That stopped. That hit a wall once Kirby Superstar came out.
Yeah.
And they had to apply that crap to a Kirby game.
Yeah, again, like Jeremy said, there was a lot of tone deafness with how their ads were treated. Like, Yoshi's Island, one of the cutest, cuddliest, beautiful, like whimsical games ever, advertised in like something that would be on Ren and Stimpy or something like that.
And someone jumps in with a guitar.
Yeah. Like they wanted to be gross out, badass. They wanted to be true Butthole Surfers of the console world.
Get your Dutch angles.
Yes, exactly. I mean, everything looked like a 90s music video, like stock footage of like the bridge shaking and like the guy getting hit with a cannonball. Like, I mean, that was in every music video. It was in all the Nintendo ads. Just like that overuse of stock footage.
Green Jelly, the console.
Yes, exactly. Hey, Maximum Carnage pops up again in this episode. So, I mean, it doesn't need to be told here, but I will tell it. And Sega was eventually outdone by Nintendo because Sega had to try harder and Nintendo really didn't. And they actually tried smarter. And instead of developing the SNES CD, other add-ons, they're like, we're going to fake it. We're going to fake it. And this is something Nintendo has done a lot over their history. They convinced us that the SNES had the power of SGI workstations, when really they created graphics on one of those and made them into animated GIFs that they turned into Donkey Kong Country. And that, I mean, that's essentially what Donkey Kong Country is, right? I mean, it's just like I made a GIF of this 3D model and I stuck it in an SNES game, and that's essentially it. But that was enough to convince people, like, let's hold off on this tech, guys. We're going to keep our SNESs.
So Donkey Kong Country was the original Tumblr shitpost?
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
Especially the awful cartoon, which I think I need to do an episode about that. So yeah,
again, can you make a whole game out of a Tumblr? Let's find out.
But again, Jeremy, we talk about
Kirby
Nintendo. Nintendo looking for cheaper solutions to address technology possibly moving on before they're ready. And we're going to talk about that with a Punch-Out episode soon. But that is how Nintendo wins, by being cheaper and smarter for the most part. I mean, obviously they've had a few losses recently, but the Wii was a huge win and it was the cheaper, smarter idea. So the SNES is nothing without its games. I whipped up a very brief list of original games that I feel are the 10 best. Maybe you guys can just pile on if you think I'm missing anything. And I did have to exclude some games because it's like I can't have like 5 Squaresoft RPGs on this thing. So
you could.
Yeah, I could, but that would be unfair. So in short, my improper list is my first cheat is Mario All-Stars plus Mario World, which was only a pack-in. But god damn it, how great is that? Chrono Trigger, Super Metroid, Yoshi's Island, Link to the Past, Earthbound, Mega Man X, Super Mario Kart, Secret of Mana, and Super Punch-Out. I admit Super Punch-Out is a personal favorite of mine.
Yeah.
That is my top 10 original SNES games. What is your favorite SNES game I either mentioned or didn't mention, and why you think it belongs in the SNES pantheon to be remembered for all time? Maybe we'll start with Tim. You're the guest, a special guest at least, and our new guest. So what SNES game is your personal favorite, and why should people play it?
Yeah, Sega Boy.
I mean, it's
come on, Sega Boy.
Oh boy, oh, I'm getting flashbacks.
My favorite, NES game is Somari, right?
Name three good Super NES games.
I mean, it always comes back to Super Mario World for me.
Yes, okay.
That is it. I mean, I have such vivid memories of, you know, like I was always looking over the fence at the greener grass of the Super Nintendo and cousins not letting me play it for like 5 minutes, and then I couldn't play it anymore. And it was until I finally like sat down in a hotel room and my parents bought me the hour of like, you know, hey, you can play a little bit of Link to the Past, a little bit of Super Mario World.
$8 a minute.
Yeah, exactly. And Super Mario World was like absolutely it. But like other favorites that really come to mind, like Blackthorn was actually on that
Blizzard selection.
Yeah, yeah, Blizzard. That was after the Silicon and Synapse name switch, right? Because it happened during this console, didn't it?
Was it?
I think so.
I think it might have been mid-gen era. But anyway, Contra 3 is way up there for me. And then, of course, Turtles in Time, which is like another one of those great examples of like growing up playing Hyperstone Heist and being like, it's pretty much Turtles in Time, right? Like, yeah. I got it, guys. Like, oh, well, there's no time traveling in this game.
Which makes it way better. Yeah, I admit my list is very safe. I try to make the safest list possible so your picks can be slightly different. But those are great.
Yeah.
And I will roll with Mario World. Like, we did a whole episode about it. It's one of my favorite ones we've done. And there's just so much going on in that game. Even though it doesn't look like the most impressive thing they could have made, I feel like it does so much. There's so much to play with, so many different items and tools and tricks and secrets. It's just so great. Ray, how about you? Like, what would you add to this list, or maybe what would you pick from this list that could be one of your favorites?
Well, Earthbound is up there. Yeah. I also really like the Goemon games, Mystical Ninja.
Oh, yeah.
And Goemon 2 especially, which is only in Japan. But
those Goemon games are really pretty.
They're really good two-player games is what they are, and I think you should definitely check those out as well. And just the other sorts of cutesier games that don't get a lot of love, like Pocky and Rocky, that series, Spike McFang. Things like that. I didn't play a lot of like the heavy hitters that everyone else had, like Turtles in Time, even though I should have loved
You wrote
Turtles
a magazine about all the Turtles games.
I'm talking about back then.
Okay.
now
how
I
dare
did.
You
yes.
do improper research, right?
Yes, as an 8-year-old. How dare I? But yeah, so like, I think now I appreciate things like ActRaiser more.
Oh, man.
Even ActRaiser 2, I think. It's like, it's a gorgeous game. I really, back then, I also really enjoyed Final Fantasy 3, 6. That was like the key RPG for me and what really I think got me into Final Fantasy the most, even though I played it before the original games and stuff. Like that really dovetailed nicely into being like teenage super Final Fantasy / anime fan and getting hyped for Final Fantasy 7 and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it hit me at the right age too. Yeah, like, oh, yeah. There's death and sadness and the world is a dark place now.
Yeah. Also Lemmings. That was like a good rental. Because, like, my friend and I would play the versus mode until, like, 4 a.m.
That's awesome. I forgot there was a versus mode.
Yeah. It's brilliant. So, yeah, Lemmings is really good for that, too.
So, Jeremy, what would you pick that either is on the list or maybe something that you thought that would be, like, a better addition?
Your list is great. I would add, for me personally, the Final Fantasy trilogy. I can't pick one of those because all of them, all three, are amazing.
It's true. Like, I really rolled with Chrono Trigger because I feel like it is sort of like, if you were going to play something, I would choose that one just because it feels like the most put together, you know, in terms of design. But I would play all of – I would definitely put all the Final Fantasies on here.
Dragon Quest V, which I didn't play back in the day but is a brilliant game. Soul Blazer, which was the best Zelda clone. Yeah. And then as a personal favorite that I realize is kind of an outside perspective, but I've really grown to love Brandish.
Really?
The Solipsist game.
Didn't you used to hate it?
Yeah,
or,
I did. Okay. Well, no. I was recruited by the Gaming Intelligence Agency to write about it for their Gauntlet of Pain fundraiser, the idea being that it's a terrible game that would be painful for me to play.
Oh, we were all young ones.
Yeah, but I mean, I played it and I was like, this is actually interesting and not bad. And as I've gotten older, I've grown to like dungeon crawlers a lot more.
Yeah.
So there's a lot I really like about it. It's awkward, and I like the remake on PSP much better. You should play it, The Dark Revenant. But it's a good game. And also, it didn't come to the US, but Sheeran the Wanderer is still brilliant when they ported it to DS in like 2009,
oh, that's
2010.
Right. That happened, yeah.
Man, that game's so good, and I'm so stoked for the upcoming Vita version,
cool. Or
Vita sequel, basically.
You know, you mentioned not putting mentioning way too many SquareSoft RPGs, but like the Super Mario RPG and tracing back. Not only is it like I think a really fun game, really colorful, a cool gameplay perspective, you know, for where you look at the game for an RPG at that time, but also I think I would have a hard time tracing back like a lot of the personality that's been injected into the Mario series over the years with like Mario and Luigi and Paper Mario and stuff. Like I feel like I trace it back to that game.
If it does feel like the first time they were able to use a lot of text within the context of the Mario universe, and maybe like we never saw Bowser being a sad sack before. That was a new angle to him, and I guess Luigi was sort of like forced out, and that kind of underlined Luigi's loserness and things like that.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, no, I think Super Mario RPG is getting a lot more respect now as people who grew up with it are writing about it.
Yeah, I think it connects more with people who are like a few years younger than us. And but for me, it was great. It like defined the summer before the N64 came out for me, basically.
So. And I also feel it was Yoko Shimomura's first defining soundtrack that her first sound. Yes?
No.
What?
Street Fighter 2, man.
That does not sound like a Yoko Shimomura soundtrack, though. I mean,
Bob's kind of right.
I am right. You know
what does
it.
Yoko Shimomura sound like? She's so diverse and so broad in her abilities.
I feel like the bouncy playfulness of her signature sound. I know that's not all she does, but I hear this in Kingdom Hearts and Mario and Luigi and things like that.
Bouncy fun. Like, how is that not the Chun-Li theme?
I mean, yes, but this was her doubling down. I will not budge from this position, Jeremy. Retronauts listeners, tell me, am I right? Because I think I am.
Stop bullying Bob.
Yes. Leave Bob Mackey alone. So I believe we have to wrap up now, unfortunately. But this has been a great discussion. I feel like it's probably better than the one I did 5 years ago. I'm more confident, probably too confident. I'm kind of an asshole. But thanks for sticking with me over these 5 years. I'm just kidding, guys. I believe in myself.
I'd be offended if I remembered that episode we did 5 years ago.
We all sound very sleepy, and I sound very reluctant about everything I say. But I feel like I think a better grasp on this stuff now. And I feel like it's great that the SNES CD has come into being. And we could have at least touched it now. Before 5 years ago, that was not possible. So, yes, thank you so much for listening. And as for me, you can find me on Twitter as Bob Servo. I also write for usgamer.net and somethingawful.com. And you can listen to my other podcast, Talking Simpsons. It's a chronological exploration of The Simpsons. Comes out every Tuesday on lasertimepodcast.com. If you like The Simpsons, you should like the show. It's that simple. Jeremy, where can we find you?
I'm in North Carolina, so come on by. You can find me at usgamer.net, on Twitter as GameSpite, and at GameBoy.world.
How about you, Tim?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter as well. It's just at Tim Turi, all one word. It's T-U-R-I. Otherwise, if you swing over CapcomUnity.com, it's Capcom-Unity.com. I am hanging out over there. We're doing cool stuff, like trying to get some more streaming going and other cool things like that. So,
and Ray?
I'm on Twitter, RDBAAA. I do a podcast that needs to record more frequently called No More Whoppers, and that's about it.
Cool. Well, we'll see you next week with a brand new mini episode. See you then.